The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Russian war against Ukraine continues to rage on. The massive flux of displaced people is challenging health services in Ukraine and its neighboring countries, as well as in the rest of Europe. The EU's Drugs Monitoring Agency, the European Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction, held an event December 14th entitled Displaced People and EU Preparedness and Response – Lessons from Ukraine. One of the speakers was Stella Bavol, a strategic advisor in infectious diseases at the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe in Copenhagen.
These last 9 months have been indeed very difficult for Ukraine and the region. And as you know, WHO is directly engaged in both Ukraine and the countries in the European region who that are hosting people who are displaced from Ukraine in providing overall support to health services and the health and humanitarian response. Actually, in Ukraine, WHO is the lead of the health cluster, and outside it's actually the UNHCR, but WHO country office is supporting through various programs and is part of the health cluster emergency response in the region. In various areas of public health and health services. Before I go to specifically to the area that I am directly involved, I wanted to cover maybe a bit more broader areas. One is on mental health. First of all, there was already a high toll of the Russian of the war in Ukraine on the people in Ukraine and those who are fleeing the horrors of war, and but the devastating energy crisis and the deepening mental health emergency constraints and the constraints on access to health services will make this winter an even more formidable test for the Ukrainian health system and the Ukrainian people. We anticipate that millions more people will be challenged to ensure their homes in warmth and safety, and they will face unique health challenges, including respiratory infections, also COVID, pneumonia, and influenza, in addition to specific health issues. All of this is also taking toll on mental health of Ukrainians, and in WHO estimations that one in five people in conflict settings would have a mental health condition, and that means that today in Ukraine about 10 million people are potentially at risk of mental disorders such as depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. In Ukraine, WHO with the Ministry of Health have signed a memorandum on cooperation to strengthen the provision of mental health services and to make mental health and psychosocial support in primary care level more accessible to people. And WHO is supporting the mental health and psychosocial support coordination group across 200 local partners, and including with placing experts, deploying them in Ukraine, in Hungary, Moldova, Poland, Czechia, and other neighboring countries to provide technical support to local authorities and humanitarian responses. And tens of thousands of psychosocial support and mental health consultations have already been held for healthcare workers as well as the general public, including mobile mental health teams who go out to community to offer care. And this is a lot of support from the First Lady, Her Excellency, Miss Olena Zelenska as well. Another one, aspect that I want to mention is the attacks on healthcare that WHO is mandated to monitor and report. And The attacks on health and the energy infrastructure have left hundreds of hospitals and healthcare facilities lacking fuel, water, electricity to meet the basic needs. And as of December, WHO has verified over 700 incidents of attacks on healthcare in Ukraine, although the actual number may be higher. And at least 100 people have died and 129 people have injured as a result of these attacks. Following the attacks on the key energy infrastructure in Ukraine, it is important to ensure that healthcare facilities can continue to function and that the pharmacies are also functioning. And we are supporting delivering life-saving supplies of medical supplies in the new accessible areas of Ukraine as well. And I mean, in the short run, there needs to be practical solutions to allow healthcare services to continue through the winter as best as they can. Obviously, this is not a sustainable solution. The war must end, then the healthcare and health of Ukrainians can be improved. In terms of needs, humanitarian ask at this point is about 10 million per month, US dollars for response in Ukraine. And there needs to be steady support from the donors and to make sure that the health needs of refugees and internally displaced people are also met. So now when if to talk about support to what we call winterization is also to help Ukraine health system work in the winter, and this includes emergency repairs to health facilities and heating infrastructure, as well as providing generators, providing prefabricated structures in newly regained areas, portable heating devices, survival blankets, diesel generators, etc. So really, if to look ahead, the challenges are going to be quite important. Now, when it comes to people who use substances, and the WHO's work in this is basically through an important mechanism to support the health sector is the weekly cluster, a working group that works on medicines, medical supplies, and procurement for the treatment of tuberculosis, HIV, and which is coordinated by Ukraine Public Health Center and WHO. And this has become a large-scale working platform for updating the real status of these areas, and already Olga has presented how this mechanism has helped support the planning and the operationalization of this work. Also, WHO has supported Ukraine with facilitating a technical working group on opioid substitution treatment to address the immediate needs of OSD patients and to advise on how to scale up and increase access. And not too long ago, and we have David also here, WHO conducted a program review in October that included the review of opioid substitution treatment program, and with some preliminary findings have been presented to the in-country stakeholders, and we are in the process of finalizing the report. But what you heard already from Konstantin and Olga is definitely the findings of this external program review is that first of all that Ukraine has an impressive opioid agonist therapy program since 2004. Since 2017, it has been fully covered by its own government support, and this not only did not impede the scale up, but actually it was an impressive scale up since 2017 on government funding of the program. And this also continued during the war. The scale up continued even during the conditions of war. And there have been also prompt decisions and, you know, at program management level to ensure service continuity and to also ensure continued access to opioid agonist therapy. And Konstantin provided those details more. But some of the key decisions were to extend the take-home doses at the beginning for 30 days. That made a huge difference for people to be able to stay on treatment. During this active war phase, there was also an increase in the new clients enrolled, including a reshifting of people from the east to the west. Obviously, this has put a strain on the providers, service providers. Many of the physicians and the service providers are increasing their patient load at a very very high numbers, and this obviously puts a strain on the also the quality of services may be declining in this, and I think we need to also see more support for the providers themselves and to expand the opportunities to diversify the number of people who are engaged in providing services. Outside Ukraine, it has already been mentioned, but because of this imposition of men not being able to be leaving the country, there's not as many people as anticipated initially to be looking for opioid agonist services continuation. And I understand it's less than 100 people who have continued according to the UPHC report, who have continued their treatment outside Ukraine and mostly in a couple of countries. We were more of a facilitator role to connect Ukraine Public Health Center with EMCDDA network to ensure that this exchange is happening. So I'll stop here to not take more time, but just to say that indeed the resilience of the program and the commitment of service providers, both on the provider side, in the clinical side, and also NGO support has been quite important and tremendous to ensure that service continue, supplies are not interrupted, the local manufacturing continues, and there's a lot of support to continue scale up under these conditions, and that is something to really remarkable. So full support for the Ukrainian counterparts. Thank you.
That was Stella Bivol, a strategic advisor in infectious diseases at the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe, speaking at an event held by the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction on December 14th, entitled Displaced People and EU Preparedness and Response, Lessons from Ukraine. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. You know, the curse of a long life is that you see too many friends and family members die. A friend of mine died January 4th of this year. Jeffrey Steinborn was an attorney, a marijuana legalizer, and social justice revolutionary. A longtime member of Normal's National Legal Committee and Normal's Board of Directors, he practiced law in Seattle for many, many years. Here's an interview I did with Jeff back in 2015. Jeff, I want to find out from you what's happening up in Washington State. I'd also like to know if you've seen this RICO suit that a group up there in Washington, well, I say a group, a nonprofit that's run by James Wooten, an old Republican Justice Department guy, called the Safe Streets Alliance. They've filed two RICO suits against businesses in the state of Colorado. Basically, they're looking to shut down legal pot in Colorado. What do you think? Have you taken a look at the suit? What do you think about it?
I haven't read the complaint yet, but I took a quick look at it. And while I don't admire their motives so much, their ingenuity is pretty sharp. And this legal theory may have some legs. You know, it's not for me to say, but it's a possibility. It's a real cause of action. And they might succeed in bringing these businesses into court and possibly shutting them down.
Well, and whether it's a legitimate thing or not, if they can get it heard in court, it's going to cost people money, and it's going to scare a lot of the businesses who are doing business with those folks in the industry. So
sure, yeah, that's right. You got to hire a lawyer, and they probably aren't going to get attorney's fees, even if you prevail. So you figure it's another expense in an industry in Washington that's already burdened with a lot of expenses, making it hard to participate.
And if they did win, it's triple damages. Do I remember that right, with a civil RICO suit?
That might be right. I didn't look at it carefully, but there is a civil RICO where you get the triple damages, yeah. Although, what are your damages? The situation, how do you corner? You know, they might get a dollar in damages and an injunction or something. And I don't know what their damages would be, how they would prove them.
So now, what is happening up there in Washington? I know that they've changed the law entirely, and there is an effort I know to try and resist some of those changes. I'm next door in Oregon, and I'm having trouble keeping track.
Well, I wish I were able to keep track of all the complex changes that have taken place in Washington law. I change it every day, and it also includes legislation involving Native Americans growing marijuana. But currently what's happened is, as we predicted a couple of years ago, when some of us became unpopular by opposing I-502, as we predicted, it's not working very well. Even the most successful business people are having trouble making money. And it's producing pot that's very expensive. And out of reach of patients. And the other thing we predicted was that in order to make 502 work, they'd have to shut down the dispensaries that have proliferated in Washington. You know, we've got hundreds of dispensaries, most of them illegal, and most of them fairly good at self-regulation. And we've had real good access to cannabis for several years now at great prices. You know, the prices that reflect how easy it is to grow. And they're all going to be shut down, according to this state, because the 502 licensed stores can't compete with them. So the letter just went out a few days ago. They've given letters to a number of dispensaries in King County, tell them they got to shut down. And we don't know what's going to happen. We really don't know. This law, the new law, takes effect over the course of a year or so, and it's got a registry. It's got very, very registered for patients. It's got very, very limited quantities a patient can possess or grow. And we think essentially what's happened is that the patients have been cut out of the transaction because the state needs the revenue, and the only way they're going to get the revenue is if the retail stores are selling all the pot. So we're kind of in turmoil here. A number of people have talked about bringing it down, I among them. The only good part about this law in Washington is that they stopped arresting people. We've gone from 7,000 arrests a year to a couple hundred, and that's fantastic. But it's also, in Washington, it was inevitable. This state was tired of arresting pot smokers. The rest of that law just doesn't work very well at all, and so some of us are discussing a lawsuit that might bring down the entire structure of I-502. And the only thing that wouldn't come down would be the criminal penalties have been removed, and they won't be replaced if we successfully defeat I-502. That'll force the state, this is the way liquor was legalized in Washington, a one-paragraph initiative that just said no more criminal penalties. And then the government was given the task of figuring out regulations, which they did. And I think this law is bad enough that it should be maybe torn down and leaving in place only the freedom from arrest, and force the state to start again and give us a better law. And, you know, the RICO lawsuit might be the way to go. I haven't studied it carefully, but it might be the way to go.
Well, now, so Washington, D.C., on the other side of the country, passed its law. They were prevented from creating a regulatory system. Instead, they have simply legalized personal possession and cultivation. Do you think that's ultimately a better model?
Well, you know, I don't know the details of the Washington, D.C., but yeah, you know, if you have a decent marijuana law that just allows people to use it, grow it, you don't need to make an exception for medical. And, you know, people are saying, well, geez, it's wild, wild west out there in Washington. But guess what? You know, we've had probably a decade of these essentially unsupervised dispensaries, and the world hasn't stopped spinning. You know, traffic accidents have gone down, opiate deaths have gone down, the rate of use among students hasn't gone up. People seem to think this stuff has to be regulated like plutonium. Well, we got about a 10-year record here that shows that it doesn't. And so, yeah, you know, it might be a good idea to tear it down and start over. And don't be surprised if you hear something like that coming out of the state of Washington real soon.
Well, it's interesting. I'll keep track. I'll keep watch. I mean, Oregon's law, of course, is only just getting started. We've got personal use and cultivation now that's become legal as of July 1st. On October 1st, the dispensaries around the state will be able to sell to anyone over the age of 21. And now, I don't know if you caught any of the testimony when they were discussing these bills, but one of the recurring themes from that was that according to the industry folks down here, very few of the dispensaries here in Oregon are making any money. A lot of them are struggling to try and get by. I used to wonder how anybody could go broke selling weed, but my gosh.
Well, I'm hearing that up here too. I mean, it depends on who you ask, but there's a lot of competition, a whole lot of competition, and so the prices have had to go down. You know, it's good old capitalism, free enterprise. So where supply meets demand, that's where the price is, unless you get a monopoly. And there's a lot of competition, but I have heard, and I don't know if it's true, that even some of the more successful I-502 licensed stores are having trouble making ends meet. Now, the growers are doing okay, I understand, but the stores are really having a hard time. I don't have any hard data on that, but I heard the number two guy in the state wasn't making it and wanted to unload his business, was someone told me the other day.
Wow.
There's money to be made, but you know, if you let the rich people monopolize it, then they're going to raise the price so high that the old black market will come back. I mean, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands, in the state of Washington who are growing pot and selling it to dispensaries. And when the dispensaries close down, those growers are not going to stop. They're having too much fun and they're making money. It's a living. So, you know, does law enforcement have the heart to start going from door to door, kicking down doors for marijuana grows? I'm not sure they do. So, yeah, the original question was, what's happening in Washington? Man, the guy who can figure that out and explain it should get some kind of award. But it's a very, very confusing situation here in Washington.
Where do you think we're going to end up in another few years? I don't even want to speculate about who will be the president at that point and what kind of Justice Department we'll have.
Well, you know, where I'd like to be and where I think will be are two different things. I personally don't see any reason why cannabis needs to be regulated any more strictly than vegetables. Certainly not more strictly than alcohol or tobacco. And if you just have an open market for it, you know, supply and demand, competition, you know, I believe in capitalism. If it's regulated, you'll get to the consumers will demand what they want, and the producers will have to give it to them, and the prices will become reasonable, and that'll meet the medical need as well. I think that's the simplest way, and of course, the bottom line of that is people got to be able to grow their own pot. Now that people have learned how easy it is, you know, people need to be able to grow their own pot. That's what breaks the back of the monopoly, if nothing else. And then if we do tear it down and we start over with some new regs, we got to look at regs that don't favor the wealthy. And if you look at what it takes to get started up in the pot business in Washington legally, you got to have a lot of dough. And what the experience has been is that not only do you have to have a lot of dough, but you got to be able to go for quite a while with that money invested before any money comes back at you. And so, you know, the underfunded and the not so wealthy are falling by the wayside, and the high rollers are taking over the business. That's monopoly, and that's when prices go up. So that's what I think is going to happen, is that monopoly is going to take over. What I hope is going to happen is that the people are going to be able to keep control of this industry, and it's going to keep from, it's going to stay a cottage industry, stay in a, format where people can afford it and get access. Hopefully. I'm dreaming, I know.
They may say you're a dreamer, but you're not the only one. I'm not going to start, otherwise I'll start singing. And then I'll probably owe somebody money, and that would just be bad. So,
we didn't publish it.
All right. Hey, Jeff, any last thoughts for the listeners?
Millions. I've said enough. You know, I think I made my position clear. I guess liberty is always unfinished business, and so it is with marijuana. Just because legalization seems to be inevitable and sweeping across the country doesn't mean that the work is done. We want to make sure that legalization gets done right. I guess that'd be my final thoughts.
Liberty is always unfinished business. I mentioned before that you are brilliant. That just says it all.
Oh, that's not my quote. That's not my quote, Doug.
Ah, well, then you got a good memory. I haven't heard it before. I'll give you credit for it.
You know, remember Eternal Vigilance is the Price of Liberty?
Oh, yes, I remember him.
Yeah, that's the original. And then I think the ACLU said it next. Liberty is always unfinished business. And it's so true because, you know, there's always somebody out there who wants to take away your freedom for your own good.
Indeed. All right. This has been Doug McVeigh for the Drug Truth Network. I've been speaking with Jeff Steinborn, a criminal defense attorney up in Seattle, Washington. Jeff, thank you so very much.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was an interview with Seattle attorney Jeffrey Steinborn from 2015. Jeff passed away on January 4th of this year. Our deepest condolences to Jeff's family. He will be sorely missed.
Well, I ask you to consider, if this is affirmed, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, and I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials, but we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.